Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to The Game, the podcast that delves into the most intriguing talking points in football today. I'm your host, Rob Fletcher, and today we're talking about the men in the dugout. Our discussion will focus on that age-old question that seems to be ever more important in modern football. What makes a manager successful in the modern game? With me in this theoretical dugout, to get stuck into our topic today, is Gary Thacker. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Rob. Yeah, so we're going to dig out the dugout.
We are.
It's going to be a fascinating chat coming up, Rob, yeah.
Yeah, and we decided to sort of talk about managers because of, obviously, Eric Ten Hag has been relieved of his duties at Manchester United, and they've got a young manager from Sporting in Portugal. Gary, what do you think it takes these days to make up the modern manager? Maybe not to be successful. What are the sort of traits and qualities that maybe Man United look for in a new manager? How is a manager supposed to behave and act, and what kind of things do they need to do in this modern era?
I mean, it's you're absolutely right to emphasise this modern era, because if you go back 20 years, you go back to the era of Ferguson and Wenger, when basically the manager was almost like chief executive, run the entire club top to bottom. But nowadays, you get it's less a manager than a coach, and very much sort of moved into the European model, where it's always been the case where, you know, a coach is given his players and away you go, coach the team. And that's very much the way it is now, and you're absolutely right. It's not only the relationship with the players that are important these days, it's the relationship with the other members around that functioning thing that makes the club work. So you've got, you know, directors of football, directors of recruitment, and so many things, you know, and obviously, you know, you've got the financial aspects as well. You've got to make it pay. So I think it's a totally different role now to what it was, you know, I say in the heydays of real managers, shall we say, who actually manage the entire enterprise. So, yeah, they've got to have this, but it is an entirely different role. I mean, it's a small part of what it used to be, but also it's much larger in other aspects as well. So, yeah, I mean, young managers, now you look at the profile of lots of managers in the Premier League now, and even across Europe, they tend to be a lot younger. Perhaps the exception is somebody like Ancelotti, but they tend to be a lot younger than they used to be because they haven't got carrying that baggage of the jobs that they used to do and don't want to give up that power.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I suppose all that time, I mean, imagine comparing managers today to managers in the 60s and 70s who would probably be involved in a lot of the scouting almost, even with negotiating contracts, transfer fees. They were kind of right at the core of what they were doing. And I do wonder actually sometimes, maybe in the 90s and the noughties, I think maybe English football scoffed at other nations' leagues for firing managers too soon. You know, how many times would you watch Gazzetta Football Italia on a weekend and see another manager's been sacked, or 18 months after taking over and spending 100 million euros, they're gone? And it was kind of that rinse and repeat sort of thing, wasn't it? That sort of hire and fire culture. And I wonder if we're now seeing that, because I think we always talk about this, don't we? The Premier League is the global Premier League now. It's not the English Premier League, really. If you look at the coaches, the head coaches, the managers, even now the sporting directors, heads of recruitment are not English anymore. Not that, you know, we're not saying that everyone's going to be English, but what we're saying is the influence of that continental model has kind of moved into football, I suppose, in England, hasn't it?
Oh, definitely, mate. And yeah, I said it was it's a different game now because of the way they coach, and it is very much more of a European situation. And it's interesting you mentioned about managers buying players. Now, obviously, a manager will sort of suggest, ask, request, but he won't make the decision. You know, I mean, and so you get players who sort of come in, and I guess an example at the moment is the Antony at Man United. Apparently, is from reading what I hear in the sort of papers, that Amorim doesn't want him. So, you know, he's a guy who was signed for best part 100 million. And suddenly, you know, because the manager's gone, he's gone. But that's, I guess that's probably a little bit of an exception rather than a rule, in as much as, I'll take Chelsea for example. Very few of the players that are playing for Chelsea were requested by or sort of selected by Pochettino in his time or Maresca now, or before that, because it was all done by the very European way of saying, You know, the directors of football, the directors of recruitment, the scouting, all that, that sort of body is what makes the decision and gets the player in if they can negotiate the deal. So perhaps the coach moving on now isn't like it used to be when, you know, I say the days of Ferguson and Wenger and perhaps Mourinho as well, when they chose the players and even, as you say, negotiate the contracts and salaries and such like as well.
And I think now what's become interesting, because you've got the money men, if you like, involved with buying the players, if you buy 10 to 15 players over 2 years and they're all to play a wing-back system or a 3-4-3 or a 4-3-3 or whatever, you now can't really employ a manager that plays 5-3-2, for example, if you've been used to a 4-3-3, because you've now got to buy additional central defenders. You're going to play fewer midfielders. You need to play a two-man strike force. So actually now, managers that are available to these clubs based on them making the decisions almost have to be part of that sort of situation. Again, I suppose for managers, the tactical fluidity they need, is that like a benefit? Or if you kind of pigeonhole yourself, well, I don't know, an attacking, pressing 4-3-3, you know that 40% of the clubs want to play like that anyway, so you're probably going to get another job. Whereas maybe this is why your Allardyces and the like stopped getting selected for these managerial roles, because they weren't part of that. Do you think there's definitely been a little bit of a shift towards maybe clubs picking managers for what they need rather than what the manager offers?
I think that's a really good point, actually. If you think about it, selecting a coach for a top club these days is almost selecting, same as selecting a player. You know, they have to fit into that sort of role. The role is pre-described almost, rather than being a successful manager. How do you play? We've got the players here. It's interesting. I mean, just a sort of, I'll say a counter-example of that is, as I understand it, Amorim plays a 3-4-3 or that's his way of playing in Portugal. And I can't imagine they'll do that here. But I mean, who knows? Perhaps he will possibly make it work. Who knows? But you do get managers now who tend to be, as you say, pigeonholed with, that's my system. And that's fine. But, you know, it's fine when you've got the players to suit that system. But when you go into a new club, if the players haven't got that, unless you've got, you know, when Maresca went to Chelsea, you've got 78 players to choose from, so you don't mind if you kick out 42 of them, you know. I mean, it's prayer and loan again. But, I think that's a really good point, actually, that, you know, the systems that the players are there, you want to, it's almost like dropping a, you know, saying a wing-back, it's dropping a wing-back in there, not like a guy who plays, you know, just a solid right-back. So the coach is almost a part, almost, well, he's part of the team and part of a team as well.
And I do find this a little bit interesting when you think about the comparison between manager and player, because someone like Phil Foden's in a bit of a bad run of form at the moment. He's not started lots of games in the league. He didn't play brilliantly in the Euros, but it's partly because the Man City system is set up to get the best out of Phil Foden. The England setup has to get the best out of many different players with many different skill sets. And you could argue that Southgate was very good at doing that. But at club level, you're almost going to build a team around a Phil Foden. I know Cole Palmer's a player, obviously, at your club, Gary Chelsea. And someone, I can't remember who was talking about actually, but they were talking about Cole Palmer like he was a playground player. Where does he play? Because what's his position? Is he a 10? Is he wide on the right? Is he a striker? Is he a second striker? Is he going to become a central midfielder? And actually, Maresca's system is probably bringing, and probably Pochettino, bringing the best out of him, because they are putting him in a position to succeed more often than not. But actually, when he comes on for England, he has to play wide on the right because you've got Bellingham in the middle, Foden on the left and Kane up front. So actually, he can't play anywhere else. So it's almost that similar thing with a manager, isn't it? You know, Amorim's coming into Manchester United and he plays a 3-4-3 or a 3-4-2-1, which actually, have Man United got the players for that? Like, are we by? It's almost like Xerxes, who they bought, who I think is quite a good player, actually, but doesn't really fit, it seems, with Hoyland and the other attackers they've got. So these managers, it's almost like when a club takes the job, takes a manager on, it's kind of almost like they can't just look at the manager. They've got to look at, well, how is he going to use Cole Palmer, our star player? How is he going to use Nicholas Jackson? Is he going to get the best out of Reece James? You know, all those sorts of players that come into it. And I do think that's even filtering down to the EFL now, because you can see teams like Swansea, for example, who played the Swansea way. So they had Russell Martin was there. Obviously, Brendan Rodgers had been there. Roberto Martinez had been there. Michael Laudrup had been there. So they've almost got a club system, as in this is how we want the club to be. Therefore, everything we do will fit into that. Do you think, and obviously Swansea haven't got back to the Premier League in the last however many years. Do you think there's a restriction, before we sort of dive into some of the managers, do you think there's a little bit of a restriction there from clubs when they not pigeonhole themselves, but only put themselves forward as a passing 4-3-3 or a aggressive 4-4-2? Do you think there's a little bit of a limitation there? Can football be sort of pigeonholed like that?
I think it can. Whether it should be, perhaps it's a different question. But I guess if you've got a system, Swansea is a good example that, you know, over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years or so, they've developed just a way of playing. And, you know, it would be crazy if, I know this isn't going to happen, but if they appointed Sam Allardyce. And here's a group of players who are used to playing, let's say, a Sam Allardyce type of manager. There's a group of players who are used to playing a set system, and they've been brought up through the academy playing that way, and the coaches players to fit that template. Somebody comes up and says, well, actually, no, we're going to, you know, play an entirely different way. It's almost suicidal, almost asking for trouble. So I think there is a lot of, well, there should be, I guess, a lot of thought goes into, you know, that the manager, like I said earlier, the manager is really part of the team system. And he has to fit in exactly as if, you know, you were buying, you know, if you're playing wing-backs and, you know, you buy a wing-back, not a sort of a solid centre left-back.
Yeah, I think I do agree, Gary, and already I can feel myself coming to some conclusions even before we've had our discussion. In terms of how maybe that sporting director is more like a 1960s manager, if you know what I mean, or a 1970s manager who's got more oversight and control of the footballing side of the club. Because, you know, managers will have gone to watch the reserve team and they'll have watched the youth team to see who was coming through, because obviously there's fewer players involved in the academy systems and there was fewer staff to look through, you know, reports from scouts and things like that. So I wonder if that's maybe where we're moving. But we're going to try and talk a little bit about success for these managers. So there's a couple of sort of things within this. Obviously, there's only a certain amount of trophies you can win, and there's a huge amount of clubs, especially these days, that compete for these trophies, whether it's the FA Cup, whether it's the Europe, the Conference League, the new Champions League. There are so many clubs involved in winning trophies that measuring success by only winning trophies is very difficult, obviously. And now we know that there's clubs who win lots of trophies, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Chelsea, Manchester United, Liverpool, Inter Milan, PSG. You know, they win cups, they win leagues, they win all kinds of things, Juventus, Bayern Munich, all of that. So for the other managers out there, and maybe we'll stick to English football a little bit, what actually defines success for a manager? Me and you, Gary, let's say we were two football managers and we get a Premier League job outside the top six or the top eight. What does it actually take to be successful these days?
I think first we need to define the concept. Success for a fan and success for a club owner are not the same thing. I mean, overwhelmingly, the people who own football clubs these days are there to make money. The altruistic butcher, bacon, candlestick maker owning a local football club is probably, you know, it might exist in the Evo sixth tier or something, but it doesn't exist in the Premier League for sure. So, you know, and it's a phrase I use quite often in podcasts. I mean, you know, for the club, people who own clubs, brass is more important than silver. For the fan, no fan has ever chanted, we've got a better balance sheet than you have. They don't care. It doesn't matter. Their success is defined by success on the pitch. So I think the manager of a, let's say, a mid-ranking Premier League club without giving any names, he's got a tightrope to walk, because, strangely enough, the people who get managers sacked are the fans. Once the fans start rebelling against it, it's the board become unpopular. Nobody wants that, and you want to move on and get somebody else, because if fans stop going, fans stop watching, fans stop buying merchandise, the income goes down, and that's the last thing the owners want. So I think it's important that, you know, these sort of mid-rankers, teams not in a European competition, shall we say. And you made a really good point, Rob. There's three, for teams in that situation, there's three trophies. There's a Premier League, where you ain't winning that tiger, and there's the FA Cup, and there's the League Cup. And it's a strange thing. I always find that, you know, for teams who sort of ain't going to win the league and probably not going to qualify for Europe and probably not going to get relegated either, tend to put weakened side out in cup competitions. Now, fans rage about these sort of things, and understandably so. However, for the club owner, finishing seventh rather than 10th is probably more valuable than finishing with the League Cup winners trophy. So I think, you know, how we define success, it's a really difficult thing, especially for the Premier League club. But I think, you know, the other thing to mention about this is, it's important that it's, we understand it's a movable feast. Lower down the pyramid, you know, if you're in the League Two and you're 17th, not getting relegated is success. If you pull a championship team in the FA Cup and knock them out, that's success. But that's trivial to other clubs. So it's a movable feast, and the situation defines how you understand success.
I totally agree with that, Gary. And I think what we're probably finding more often than not, especially in the top flight, is the fact that the idea that there's only three trophies, but there's a lot of money at stake in the top division, depending on what position you finish, as you say. Maybe the difference between 10th and 7th is the difference between what striker you can sign in the summer, because that extra 5 or 6 million might pay for signing on fees, bonuses, higher wages or whatever when it goes on the balance sheet. And I think that is a real challenge, isn't it, for managers to actually balance what they want. If they're being told they've got to stay in the Premier League, then when they go to Stoke away in the third round of the League Cup, they can't afford for their top striker, centre midfielder, centre back, and best winger to get injured, fatigued, and knock. Because if the Saturday game against Ipswich at home is one he's got on his sheet that he's got to win, and that's so tricky. But as a club who was probably one of those mid-ranking Premier League teams, the 3 years between finishing with a Carling Cup win, then we followed that with a quarter-final in Europe and finished seventh in the Premier League, and then followed that with a UEFA Cup final, I don't think we're going to get much better than that over a three-year period. And what an amazing period that was, and we got to see some brilliant players. Because as soon as you've got Europe, you get players like Viduka, Hasselbank, Yakubu, Zenden, all those sorts of players want to come and play for you. Therefore, you start seeing better football. But actually, what happened to us is because we'd overspent in that time, the next manager, we couldn't spend as much. And we didn't spend the high wages. We had to buy younger players where we could spread the transfer fee on less weekly wage. And eventually you go down, and we've been back for 1 year since. Having that ambition and that success almost worked against us as a club. It didn't help that we had a rookie manager in Gareth Southgate who couldn't quite navigate that at the start of his career, which is totally understandable at the same time. But as a manager, obviously for him, he was going up against a trophy-winning manager, you know, a manager who'd got into Europe. So that's almost a very tricky thing following on from that as well, isn't it? I always think the next manager sometimes has it harder than the one they've got. I always think about this, about Thomas Frank at Brentford. So Thomas Frank gets linked with a lot of top jobs. I think he seems really happy at Brentford, seems like a really nice guy, talks football really well, is more than happy to share his ideas, keeps Brentford in the league quite comfortably. I think he could probably do a top six job. He could do a Tottenham or a Man United or something like that. But then what happens to that next Brentford manager when they come in? What a job they've got to follow. So I think that's a real challenge, as you say, around balancing. Because for Brentford, you might think, well, a trophy's next for them, isn't it? Because they seem like a really solid Premier League team, got some good players, and maybe that's the next step for them. So what do we think then these managers need to do at these clubs? It could be that if it's in the Championship, League One or whatever, to actually, what's success for them? If we think they can't win a trophy, and yes, they might finish mid-table, so they're going to get a load of money in the Prem. But if they're in the Championship at Swansea or Middlesbrough or Preston, what's their role? Are they just a custodian, you know, managing these other players for these director recruitments? What is going to get them success? And maybe ultimately, like a player would, like you were saying before, Gary, about these managers almost being like players, what's actually going to get them the next move up the food chain? What's going to kind of prove to the next owner, I want Rob Fletcher, the manager of Swansea, because he can do X, Y, and Z? What is that X, Y, and Z that they need to prove?
If we know the answer to that, Rob, we'd be making fortunes telling these clubs who to employ. But I think, you know, from a manager's point of view, the first thing is don't get the sack. Don't get the sack. Keep your job. Strangely enough, success in the Championship can often be counterproductive. I remember Billy Davies, who was manager of Derby, got promoted. Ridiculous understrength team, but miracles getting promoted. I think they got relegated with 11 points at the end of the season or something. He got the sack. And if he hadn't gotten promoted, if he'd gone to the playoffs and lost in the playoff semi-final, it'd have been Lourdes brilliance. And, you know, so, I mean, Rob Edwards now at Luton, got them through the league, got into Premier League, they got relegated, and now they're struggling, I think, near the bottom of the Championship. And all of a sudden, the people who lauded him, saying he was a brilliant manager, they're saying, oh, you've got to go now, Tiger. I mean, it's a really difficult situation. There's a guy called Bella Gutman who coached Benfica many years ago, and he coached all over the world, but he'd been Benfica in the European Cup, and he said a manager should only be there 2 years because the third year is toxic. So you either move when you're in success, and you look at people like, I'll say, like Rob Edwards and like Billy Davis, and there's probably many others who have got clubs promoted and got relegated and, you know, or got sacked before they get relegated because they're in trouble. I mean, Gary O'Neill now at Wolves, he had a really good season with them last season. Great success, certain more than they were anticipating. All of a sudden, in trouble now at the bottom of the league. They played ridiculously. They played Man City, Chelsea. I think they played Liverpool as well. So they had some really rough fixtures. And their sort of confidence has been, and he's getting ragged now, and they're saying he's got two games to save his job and all this sort of thing. And so I think the first thing is perhaps don't get too successful too quick. Just build it. Because if you don't get, when you've got that sort of successful first couple of years, if you don't get off of the next job, the odds are things will change eventually and you'll sort of suffer. So it's really difficult if you're a manager to say, you know, you want to be successful, but not too successful. And I mentioned off air before we started, I saw a tweet this morning. We recorded this on the Sunday, just after the Premier League games on Saturday. There was a guy who put, a Man City fan who said, Pep Guardiola's run out of ideas, the players lost faith, and it's time for him to go. Now, this guy, that was the first league game City have lost, I think, in 33 games, certainly well over 30 games. They're European champions, they're British champions. They only missed out on the double by losing in the cup final. And this is success. I mean, talk about a thin line between success and failure. My God, what do you want?
I think it is that weird area. Like you said, I think you made a great point there, Gary, about the third year being the toxic one. Because Mourinho always had that, didn't he? He had that third season syndrome where he kind of almost get a little bit too much power and then it wouldn't quite work because almost you need a little bit of abrasion, don't you? A little bit of kind of conflict with the directors or with your sporting. I really need a striker. Get me a striker. No, but you've got two strikers, but I need this third one. And in the first two seasons, when you get your own way and it works, the director of football goes, well, maybe he does know more than me. Maybe when he asks for a fourth striker for 50 million, I just need to get it for him because he's already proved me wrong. But then actually, when it goes wrong, the director of football has ultimately got the power to say, you're out, not me. Do you know what I mean? It's that kind of thing, isn't it? And the Gary O'Neill one's a good point, isn't it? Because what I find now is, I think Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard are possibly finding this out as well. You can't have a managerial career where you do well early these days, I think, because like Lampard got Derby into the playoffs. Obviously, they got to Chelsea. Tuchel obviously replaced him during the season. Obviously, they had a transfer ban and all that sort of stuff. But I feel like I looked the other day and they were unbeaten in the Champions League group, I think, when they obviously then went on to win the Champions League.
And he brought so many players through from the academy, which they've now sold on massive profits.
Yeah, exactly. And then you've got someone like Gerrard, who won the league with Rangers, obviously got a decent job at Villa. Unfortunate for him that he was followed by Unai Emery, who's a very successful manager, trophy winner manager, more experienced, all that sort of stuff. But now he's kind of out-earning probably three times as much money as he would have got in the English Premier League. But no Premier League's going to take him. No Premier League club's going to take Gerrard. And there's probably not going to take Lampard either. Because actually, the proof for them is, can you keep me in my current position or better? Isn't it almost? With Lampard, it was like, if you don't come in the top four or win the league, you're out. But actually, how can you win the league by Christmas? Chelsea are never going to go down. You know what I mean? You're not going to get into that position. So I find it really interesting that these managers, especially younger managers, when they come in early, are probably on a little bit of a hide into nothing. Wayne Rooney's another one. You know, his Plymouth side lost on the opening day of the season really heavily. Everybody wrote him off. Then they went on a bit of a run and everyone's saying, oh, Rooney's going to be great. Now they've had a couple of big defeats again. Rooney's going to be terrible again. It's very kind of binary, isn't it? You're either a really good manager or you're really bad. And it could be within the same week.
You're right. You're right, Rob. I mean, living over in Spain, it tends not to happen so much where the celebrity player gets the job. It's strange, I've been looking back at the manager who's been successful in England. Mourinho, hardly ever played. I think he was a substitute goalkeeper in a couple of games. Wenger, hardly ever played, certainly not a top tier. Ferguson played for Rangers, but you know was never a sort of, you know, world-class player. The managers who've been successful in England tend to be, I always say about managers, and the great managers who failed, like great players who failed as manager, like Zola, for example. The great players never really knew how they did it. It was natural, they had that skill. Whereas the sort of your journeyman footballer had to work hard to understand how to get that. And I was saying that over here in Spain, it's very unusual for star players to get promoted ahead of where they should be. It doesn't tend to happen. And it's interesting about Villa, I've got my son-in-law and his family, all of their fans, and when they're appointed Unai Emery, they've said we've stopped appointing trophy managers and they're appointed a trophy winning manager. You know, because the sort of celebrity, you know, glitter doesn't always work. In fact, it very rarely works, especially in English football. So, yeah, I mean, Rooney is really good case in point. He started down in the lower levels, went to Derby, and that didn't work. But that's you know, they were a bit of in trouble anyway, financial trouble. But, you know, he's sort of like serving his apprenticeship now. Now, if he is successful with Plymouth and, you know, moves up, great. But he wasn't dropped in the deep end. He walked into the shallow end and, you know, got his water wings on for a bit rather than being dropped in and found he couldn't swim in the 14-foot end.
Yeah, and he's an interesting case because he's now on his fourth club as a manager. He's been at Derby, DC United, Birmingham and now Plymouth. I mean, at that early stage, he's probably going to get a lot of experience from that and probably learn quite a lot from it. But then as a director of football or sporting director, I might be thinking, but why has he had four clubs already? It's like those football players, isn't it, who move every season. Why does nobody keep them? Why does everybody keep spending 25? Because obviously there's some potential there. You know, maybe it's the name and that kind of thing. So I suppose it's a tricky thing, isn't it? But I think what we're seeing from a lot of these managers who maybe don't win trophies because there's only a few trophies available, I feel like a lot of them are down to they fit the club identity and the style that the club wants. Therefore, that's what will get them the job. You know, if their principles match up with the sporting director or how they want to play, then that'll actually fit with them. It might be that they're not asking for lots of money. So like someone like Gary O'Neill, who basically they just keep selling all their best players to make sure they're financially viable. And last season, he probably overachieved massively with the squad he had, but then didn't get any investment really. I know they bought Strand Larsen, didn't they? I think this is the main sort of...
Sorry,
I was on loan, right. So as the main summer striker, but the players that keep selling, they're not replacing. So again, how is he meant to kind of overachieve, if you like, if you keep stripping assets?
Yeah, you're absolutely
from the club.
They sold Neto to Chelsea, they sold the centre-half to West Ham and bought a goalkeeper. Now, the goalkeeper they had already, Jose Sarr, was more than decent. And in fact, he's first-team choice there. So it's almost like they sold their best forward, their best defender, and bought a goalkeeper they didn't need, who was actually getting splinters in his backside, sitting on the bench. So, you know, perhaps these director of recruitment perhaps ain't that bright after all. So, you know, but they're not going to pay the price. Then again, I like to say, you know, no fan ever chance we've got a better balance sheet than you have. That no fan ever shouts, sack the director of recruitment. It's sack the manager.
Yeah, it's sack the manager because he's not getting the best out of the players that we think are good, isn't it? It's that kind of approach, isn't it? Rather than we've got the wrong players or player X is not as good as player Y or whatever. It's that kind of thing, isn't it? If you're not replacing like for like, there's only so much that a manager can do. To actually, I mean, part of a manager's job obviously is to develop players, but I would actually argue that that's not actually that true anymore. And a manager's job is to get to develop players to play the system more effectively. So if you look at Chelsea with Maresca, they felt like Pochettino couldn't play the system they wanted to see. Therefore, they got a new manager because they thought that Maresca would get better out of the players in the system that he played. Not that he's necessarily a better man manager or a better development coach. I know he's worked in youth football and whatever else. But actually, is that more where managers are moving towards in the sense that they can fit the style? A bit like the right back. If you play with a marauding right back, you're going to buy him over an Aaron Wan-Bissaka, who's more a solid defender but not as good an attacker. It's that kind of approach that clubs are almost taking now, isn't it, with their managers?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And, I guess there's some teams, some clubs where it's different. I mean, you might say Real Madrid because they can, you know, sign that and go out and buy some new players and flood the players they've got because they're decent anyway. But yeah, for the majority of clubs, I'm sure that's true. It's a system. It's almost system rules. It's interesting. I was just thinking while we were talking then, you pick 100 fans of almost any Premier League club and ask them to name the manager of the club. 100 will know it. Ask them to name the director of football. It was probably more powerful and certainly more influential in the way the team develops and particularly where who is the manager as well. And I guess somewhat less than 100 would know the answer.
And also what's interesting about that is, especially with some of the clubs, you should know their name because they're the one who's making some of the mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
you know, they're absolutely. The ones who are spending the money on a £40 million striker that no one's ever heard of that the manager doesn't actually want. But like you say, Gary, that it'll be the manager who's moved on. not that big striker because you spent the money and you can't. It's interesting, I think, this conflict that we're sort of talking about at the minute between this director of football and the manager. The director of football thinks the £40 million strike is worth every penny and should be playing. So he doesn't want to admit that, so he's got to play. But then the manager, who's got his own principles and style, he doesn't want to change his style or system because he doesn't almost want to give in to the director of recruitment, who it's that kind of, and obviously in a successful club, that might be healthy conflict, as in, you know, we want this player, not that player. Let's have a discussion about, like, quite a lot of people talk about the recruitment teams going over and above the manager to buy players. Now, I probably think that's true for maybe under 21 players. So players that are going to be in the under 21s or under 18s, and they're probably going to be there longer than the manager. I know Chelsea have started to do that a little bit with players. And I get that because Maresca is probably going to be gone in 2 or 3 years. So I understand that, because when that 17-year-old's 20, you don't want him to be a Maresca player. You want him to be a Chelsea player. And then he can fit into the... And I understand that. But actually, the manager, like you said, they want to sort of win now. So that element of what they're doing on the pitch is almost, it's so crucial, isn't it? But at the same time, you kind of don't want to fall out with your director of football because you might need other players. So this kind of abrasion, I think, is quite tricky. It must be quite difficult for modern managers to actually walk the tightrope, mustn't it, compared to what they think they would have done going into a new club.
Definitely. You see, I mean, it doesn't happen so much perhaps with, you know, the top echelon of clubs in the Premier League, but certainly in the mid to low ranks, and perhaps in the Championship as well. Perhaps probably even more so in the Championship. You know, a manager will get appointed and he'll say, my job here is to bring players through from the youth team. Well, that's going to take 5 years. You're going to be gone in two, Tiger. So yeah, that's never going to happen. You know, I say never, but it's really unusual for a manager to stay that long. So, you know, when a manager is appointed by a club and the club says, you know, we've got a great academy, we haven't got much money, bring these players through. You're all hiding to nothing, because if you do start developing them, you're not going to be there long. The guy after you is going to get the benefit, not you. So yeah, it's modern football is really sort of, I don't know, as we've said, it's so different to what the game was 20 years ago. And yet, it's living over in Spain, you get used to a different system, and it's certainly more akin to the system here now than it was those couple of decades ago.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And I think in the Championship, even more so, if you've only got, I don't know, £3 to £5 million to invest maybe in your club, sign and play. Like Preston are a good example of that. They have a very small budget, but keep themselves, you know, in the top 14 of the Championship most seasons. Sometimes they threaten the playoffs if they go on a bit of a good run or one of the players turns good, kind of thing. But they've got to invest really wisely. So they have gone through a few managers recently, but they've got to fit that ethos, because they're not going to all of a sudden spend £12 to £15 million and probably aren't going to appoint a Frank Lampard or a Wayne Rooney or a Steven Gerrard, because they can't afford to do that. They need someone who knows the ropes, who knows them well, and then can sort of move them forward. Do we think then some of these managers who maybe, we mentioned Thomas Frank already, I was thinking of a few other examples who we could probably say have done really well without maybe achieving that success from a trophy point of view. Like Marcelo Bielsa was one that always comes to mind that managers feel really influenced by. Obviously, he came to Leeds, and in his second season, the Championship, they won the league. They probably should have got promoted the first season, but a few games at the end, they weren't great. Finished in the top 10 of the Premier League, ended up getting sacked because he wouldn't change his style. And he feel like, going, if you're going to sack Bielsa for not changing his style, you don't know who Bielsa actually is, because he's been playing this style since, what, the 80s, early 90s when he got into management. But he's a really good example of someone who's got principles, and almost like you're buying into Bielsa rather than him buying into you, if you know what I mean. But he was a great success, wasn't he, at Leeds, and played some fantastic football.
Yeah, I mean, Bielsa's got a sort of, I say, checkered history, a sort of an up and down history, success and then moving on. How many clubs he's had? I think he's managing Uruguay national team at the moment, I think. But he's certainly been around a few clubs. I mean, he had a great team at Athletic Club up in Bilbao a few years back. So he's had some successful clubs, but he never really stays that long, as you say. I think just sort of, you know, flag up, you know, the success of sort of, we don't consider success, or if anybody had said before the season started that by the end of October, Nottingham Forest would be in the top three of the Premier League, yet again, I laughed at. Now, this is a guy, I mean, Nuno Espirito Santo took over the team, And I mean, without, I mean, there was a lot of money spent on the team beforehand, but I don't think he's signed many players. But he's got that team playing wonderfully well. And I say that, I mean, ahead of the games on Sunday, which might change it a little bit, but certainly the, as we lie now today, they're in third place. So the success he had, and going back to his time at Wolves, they were really doing well, and they'd sort of plateaued a little bit. And they so they got rid of him, and they brought in a guy called Bruno Lage, who was, I think he was coach of Benfica's reserve team or something like that. Absolute disaster. Ripped the team to pieces, fell apart, and got sacked within 12 months. So you get this sort of, what do you want? What do you expect? What's reasonable to expect? And come back to Amorim, Man United fans now. I mean, Man United fans, and probably every fan thinks their club special. Every fan thinks their club special. And you have overinflated ideas of what you should be able to expect. As we lie now, and certainly for the past, I mean, Man United haven't threatened a league title for good many years, and good many years. And yet Man United fans still think they're one of the top clubs, top teams in the country. But there's no real evidence to back that up. You know, the Ferguson era, post-Ferguson era, is sort of, is a steady drift down. They won a couple of pots in the way, but certainly nothing more than, you know, a sort of top half team would perhaps expect to compete for. They'll be expecting Amorim to come in and put them into a title challenging position very quickly. I mean, if he does, brilliantly. And if he does that, he has been brilliant, because it's just the team they've got at the moment is not of that calibre. But he were into the situation of what success. For a Man United fan, success would be challenging Liverpool, challenging the noisy neighbours across the city. And it's just not reasonable at the moment. Fans aren't reasonable about success, I guess, are they?
No, I don't think so. And I think a couple of points that you made there, Gary, are really interesting. I think the Bielsa point, Marcelo Bielsa has been successful because he's always in work. You know, we know, you know, as we're obviously not football managers, unfortunately. But, you know, in your own life, in your own work, the idea is that you stay in your job, isn't it? You know, and you can maybe move up the food chain in your own profession. You might become a leader or team, whatever it is. Bielsa stayed in work. So actually, whatever he's done has worked because he still gets jobs. Like already we're talking about Lampard. I know Gerrard's working, obviously, at the minute. But Lampard, you know, he might have gone for other jobs. Roy Keane's talked about going for lots of other managerial jobs. Can't get work. He took Sunderland to promotion, etc., etc. I think someone like that is interesting. And the Wolves case study, I hadn't thought of it, but that's a really good study of how the actual behind-the-scenes team are getting it wrong. So Nuno Espirito Santo, and this is, again, another thing where I think it's really important to point to make. Nuno Espirito Santo now has managed 500 games of football. 500 games. And he's obviously used to working, because he's worked in Portugal, he's worked a bit in Spain, and probably at Wolves. He's had players sort of imposed on him. You know, we're buying these players and that's it. Forest is almost like a dream job. Someone like Steve Cooper, who was there and got them promoted, he's very much, he worked in a lot of the youth teams. He's very much a player development kind of manager. You know, and I think Leicester fans probably weren't enamoured with that appointment because it doesn't feel very exciting. It doesn't feel very different.
It's not sexy.
You know what I mean? It's not. It's Steve Cooper. But actually, he's probably a really good developmental coach. So actually, if he gets a decent mid-table Premier League team to start with, he might be better on mid-table Championship team. But Nuno, he's used to this. Yeah, give me the players, I'll deal with it. If I have to play 4-5-1, I will. If I need to make it a 4-3-3, I will. If I've only got Chris Wood, I'll make sure I get loads of crosses in the box. Because he's been through what Gary O'Neill's going through now, probably. You know, that bit where it's not going that well.
Yeah.
Yeah, the same club. Because he managed 200 games for Wolves. He's got a nearly 50% win rate at Wolves. And that's phenomenal. If you think where Wolves were, I know they've had a lot of money pumped into them. But then Spurs take him on. And again, it's Nuno is not a Spurs manager, if you know what I mean. Because they do need someone who's probably a bigger name. But actually, Nuno, a club like Forest is perfect. Because he doesn't have to worry about anything apart from getting the very, very best out of that set of players. And that's it. Spurs is so different. We haven't won a trophy. We want to be top four. We want to be in the Champions League. It's all these ambitions, like you say, Gary, that these clubs have got. Where's your proof, Spurs? Where's your proof that you're... I mean, Pochettino got you in the Champions League final, blah-de-blah. Where's your proof that you win things? Where's your proof that you're Champions League? It's not there. So if Nuno doesn't win them, he's just done exactly the same as every other manager. And I'm just finding that a little bit now. I think Postecoglou, with a little bit of abrasion again, shall we say, from maybe fans... maybe behind the scenes and that kind of thing.
You're dead right, mate. When I mean, my wife's a Wolves fan and she loves, you know, and she said, he's the best man. I said, what about me? I'm second best, apparently. Because when he was at the Wolves, well, he bought into the city. He did a lot of charity work in the city and that sort of thing. So he was very popular. When he went to Forest, they didn't say, no, you've got to get us into the Champions League. They would just look to survive. So the bar for him, where once you reach across that bar, you're successful, was very low. And he's clearly bought with miles to spare, as opposed with Amorim. When he goes to Man United, that bar is massive, massive. And to clear it all, you're going to be amazingly successful. And I mean, I don't imagine Nuno's team will finish in the top three. Probably not in the top half. But and he's got Murillo, the centre half, has been chosen for the Brazil squad. Now, that wasn't going to happen 12 months ago. So, I just think you look at success and what's expected of you is really what the fans expect. And the fans didn't expect that great amount of that, neither did the board. So there wasn't that sort of conflict, really. As long as he kept them up and, you know, if he got a mid-table, that would be great. You know, the success has been amazing from there. So that definition of success was so easy for him to achieve. Well, not so easy, but relatively easy compared to some other tests.
Yeah, I mean, they've got a point more than Arsenal as it stands. You know what I mean? They've lost one game. They're already, 40 points is more than enough to stay up these days. They're halfway to that now after 10 games.
Yeah, they won at Anfield.
Yeah.
They came to Chelsea and got a 1-1 draw and were lucky not to win. So, it's not as if they've been playing, the bottom six teams all the way through. So, brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And I wonder if we've talked about these managers and what's the next move for them and how do they fit in. You wonder if for a manager like Nuno, managing clubs of a similar stature to Nottingham Forest. Obviously, Nottingham Forest have got stature in terms of they've won European trophies in the very distant past now, let's say. Very, very distant past. But maybe a club like Wolves, Nottingham Forest, a Brentford maybe now, that's the level of manager they should be going for, because just financially you can't really compete. I think Brighton found this a little bit. Obviously, they had Chris Hughton who kept them up by the skin of their teeth. People forget this. People forget they had Chris Hughton. And they were quite dogged and they were quite direct and they stayed up. And then they thought, right, now we've stayed up, there's probably going to be three teams worse than us the following season. So then they bring Potter in, who was obviously at Swansea, ironically, build that system. Potter gets them ninth. Right, we get De Zerbi, gets us, and I think it went a bit wrong for them. But now they've got a really young manager in. But I think the problem is people are missing out steps on the ladder. So, a Middlesbrough, Norwich or whatever, they're trying to get to the 32-year-old German manager who's going to take us to the top eight. Actually, no, you need the Chris Hughton first to get you up, keep you up. Then you need to get the Graham Potter, who can change your football a little bit. But remember, Potter was finishing like 16th, 15th until that one season. You've got to build, and I think Chelsea suffered from this a little bit, where they've almost gone too quickly into, right, let's get Graham Potter in because he's going to do it for us. No, actually, the Pochettino should have been first, probably. Get the Pochettino. It's that kind of thing. If maybe these managers as well, when the clubs are looking for managers to build them up, they can't miss out steps. They've got to build it from like a solid foundation. And you could argue that maybe Villa have kind of accidentally done that. And obviously, they got Monchi in as well as the sporting director, who's
a top guy.
Massively, and he's mates with Emery, and they've won trophies together at Sevilla, and they've obviously got a good relationship. And now they can build that next level. It's interesting, isn't it, when you look at it? Because Emery looked like, not a disaster at Arsenal, but it looked like a bit of a misstep. But again, you're following Wenger. It's like Moyes going to Manu. You're following a man who's won everything nearly.
Don't follow the guy. Don't follow the guy. Be the guy who follows the guy who follows the guy. Don't follow the guy. Yeah, you make a really good point there about Nuno. And I think it's true of Thomas Frank as well. Before O'Neill, the job, Wolves employed Lopetegui. It was very successful. Former manager of the national team, former manager of Real Madrid. And you're thinking, okay, this isn't the next step, but perhaps they didn't. That's not his club. That sort of club is not his club. And he fell out with the owners because they wouldn't spend money. Well, whether they could or didn't want to is a moot point, but they didn't spend money. So he walked out literally a week or so before the start of the season when O'Neill had to get parachuted in. Now, who can say? If he'd have gone from there to Newcastle, where there's lots of money, it might be a situation, but he went to West Ham. They were not in a not terribly dissimilar situation to what Wolves are. And, you know, it's in the same situation. They've not really been that successful. And, you know, you talk about Nuno. Forest or Wolves, similar sort of club, both with great history, but of recent times, success has been sort of quite sort of limited. And you mentioned about going through, the getting promoted players, different cultures, different areas. I mean, when Wolves in the fourth division, they appointed Kenny Jackett as manager, and he got them promoted. Was it the guy before? It was before Kenny Jackett. Then Jackett took over. Then Mick McCarthy. And they got stepped through. And they had a manager, for the coach for the right division. And it was really successful at what they did. And when you get clubs promoted in the Championship, it's very hard to say to the manager, the coach has got promoted, I'm sorry, guy, but we've got to pick up somebody who's a bit more akin to Premier League football. But perhaps that's the way to do it. I mean, you know, if you work for any business and, you know, you become more successful and you buy another company, you suddenly, instead of turning over 1 million, you send it over 25 million, you don't necessarily want the same guy running that company because he's not really attuned to that sort of, I don't know, it's just a difficult one. There we go. I mean, this sort of question that you asked at the start, what defines success for a coach?
And it's really tricky, isn't it? Because you've got someone like Russell Martin, who at Southampton, he's another ex-Swansea manager, and now at Southampton, he is very wedded to his style, shall we say. But you're letting in 2 goals a game and you're not averaging 1 goal a game. You're not in the Championship anymore. Your players aren't infinitely better than everybody else, or at least 14 teams in the league. So actually, what are you going to do as a manager? And maybe when we talked at the start about, you know, a manager should fit the club's identity, the club's style, that kind of thing. But you mentioned, Gary, at the start about, but also the boardroom, they want the money. They want to be in the Premier League every season, earning 150 to 200 million pounds a season. So actually, is Russell Martin the man? He might be the man if you go down and you need to get straight back up again. You know, if he sticks it out this season, which I'm not 100% certain he will, but they go down and he might get them back up again because they've got better players than all the other teams in the league. My other one about this is, lots of fans who support Championship clubs, Scott Parker. When people look down from the Premier League, Scott Parker, they're gonna definitely get promoted. He's gonna get them in the top 4. But Scott Parker's not going to Preston. He's not going to Plymouth. He's not going to Rotherham. He's going to Burnley, who've already got 50 million quid's worth of players playing the Championship. He's going to Bournemouth, who've got a squad that Eddie Howe built. He's going to Fulham, who've got a Premier League squad. Is there a reason why Scott Parker doesn't get Premier League jobs? Well, yes, because he can't manage at that level. And maybe for Parker, what a great 30-year career he might have as a manager, being a bottom 3 Premier League manager and a top 3 Championship manager, because he might end up with 10 promotions on his CV. Neil Warnock, isn't it? I've got 8 promotions. Yeah, Neil, you only manage promotion contenders. That's
why. And relegations, you've got Neil as well. There's an interesting one. I mean, I saw yesterday, it was yesterday or the day before, Shelbourne won the Irish League yesterday. At the start of the season, they were 25-1 to win it. Their coach is Damien Duff. You wonder how many clubs in England are looking at Damien Duff. Now, I don't know how much he's on the show, but obviously they'll love him. He's very so popular over there. But you wonder how many clubs in the English League are looking at Damien Duff and thinking, this guy's got a name as well, and he's successful. And really, you took that another steps issue that you mentioned earlier. I wonder how many steps they'd be missing out if a Championship club persuaded Damien Duff. And he may not want to leave him. I mean, the guy's not an idiot. I mean, he knows he's a sort of novice in the job. But there again, you're thinking, you know, success in, you know, Shelbourne, is this an opportunity or is it a curse almost for a manager that you suddenly get plucked and dropped into the deep end? You know, you've still got your water wings on.
Yeah, and it's very different football, different budgets, different players, different everything, isn't it? But actually, he might be really good at developing a style, developing young players, getting you into a certain position. And maybe you have a Damien Duff for 2 or 3 years and he stabilises you and he gets you in the top 10 and then you move on from him. And maybe these managers need to think about, right, I need to find who's the next club. I imagine Damien Duff to be like a Preston-type manager. You know, he'll manage sort of mid-range or Blackburn maybe. Obviously, he played there before.
He played before, yeah.
He kind of that mid-range Championship team who are looking to finish in the playoffs if they can and hopefully get promoted or whatnot. But it's a tricky balance, isn't it? I suppose, again, with a lot of these discussions, there are so many different factors because it almost depends where you are, depends what league you're in, depends where you are within the mini-league. Like the Premier League, they always say, don't they? It's like 3 mini-leagues, isn't it? It's the top eight, the bottom six, and the rest. Which league are you the best manager in? And maybe, like, for a Nuno, he's going to be the best manager you can get for the middle league. So actually, if, you know, Forest think ideas above the station and want to get a different manager in, Nuno might go, well, hang on, I've finished top of the middle league for the last 3 years with Forest. Get me in, and I'll get you Wolves from 14th to 10th or 14th to 11th. And that's kind of maybe how these managers...
And that's a massive success. It's a massive success, yeah. Rob. It's a massive success, you know. That, I mean, as a, you know, there we are back to that same situation of what defines success. If you can do, be that guy that sort of takes you from lower half to upper half and do that on a regular basis, because that's your niche, that you're successful, that you know how to make that work, that's entirely as worthy as being a guy who gets the job at Man City with, you know, 17 gazillion pounds to spend and goes and win the European Cup. It's no less worthy, and probably the success is of a similar value.
Yeah, definitely. It's when you used to get these sort of relegation specialist managers, wasn't it, who'd come in for the last five games and keep you up or whatever, wasn't it?
Fireman Sam, yeah. It's the value added that, you know, and I guess what we're talking about here is it's the value added that the manager can deliver for a club. And does that equate to the aspirations of both the club and the fans? And we're into the tightrope. That's three tightropes you've got to walk there, so that's been impressive.
Yeah. But I think that's probably a great point to end on, Gary. It is walking that tightrope, isn't it? And how much value are you adding to the club? You know, are you leaving the club in a better position than when you started there? Can you even do that as a manager? I suppose putting it out to the listeners, maybe you could comment on the X posts that we share or whatever with the podcast. Tell us about your manager. Do they fit this kind of modern definition that we're talking about, where they've got to have a good relationship with their sporting team? They've got to have a good relationship with data and scouting and developing youth players. Are they doing well in your little mini league, in your league? Are you overperforming that? Or do you feel like maybe you need someone that little bit better? So that'd be great to get people's insight on that. But Gary, a great chat. And I think we probably could do more and more episodes on managers and things like that, couldn't we?
We could, Rob. But next time we come on this month, let's get the ball out and have a kick about a bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, so, great chat, Rob. Brilliant, Jordy. Thanks, mate.
From me and Gary in the dugout, we'll pass over to you, our assistant coaches, to give us some feedback and let us know how your managers are getting on. But from us here at The Game and These Football Times, we will see you next time.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.